It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about the court hearing on President Trump's immigration ban, a conflict between Senators Elizabeth Warren and Mitch McConnell over the Jeff Sessions confirmation, and more in our weekly look at national politics.
First, plans to complete the Dakota Access Pipeline are moving forward. In a court filing yesterday, the U.S. Army said its deputy secretary would grant the final permit needed to finish building the pipeline.
Reports say that the move was immediately supported by Republicans in Congress. It also got strong opposition from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, which has been front and center in opposition to that pipeline. The tribe has been concerned about the pipeline running so close to its water source and sacred sites.
If completed, the project would carry hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil a day. The pipeline route would originate in North Dakota and carry oil to southern Illinois.
Ernest Scheider joins us now. He's an energy correspondent for Reuters. Ernest, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Let's talk about the significance of this step, this easement being granted. How important is this?
Well, it was crucial to Energy Transfer Partners, which is the company that wants to build the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is the easement that the Obama administration had denied the company last fall. And so basically, the Trump administration is reversing that and allowing them to tunnel underneath the Missouri River and basically connect the two parts of the pipeline that are already constructed.
This, unless there are court challenges, we could talk more about that. This would be, what, the last step? This is the plan can fully go ahead as of now?
Correct, yes. This allows them to move forward if it's issued. So what happened yesterday is technically the U.S. Army said that it was going to, and then this afternoon it should actually do that. So that's more or less a formality. Them saying that they're going to do it is sort of the final piece of paperwork that needs to take place for Energy Transfer Partners to be able to do this. Of course, as you said, there's a lot of legal options in the court system that could still gum things up. But as far as the regulatory framework, Energy Transfer Partners has what it needs now.
So starting tomorrow, how soon could we see construction start on the most controversial parts of this pipeline?
Well, of course, it is North Dakota, and it is quite cold there right now, and a lot of the ground is frozen. So it all depends on how much money Energy Transfer Partners wants to spend on things like, thawing the ground, ground heaters, and other equipment. It shouldn't be that hard to bore through if they decide to go ahead of that. It depends on how cold it gets, though. If the fluid that's used around the tunneling bore heads, if it gets around 20 or 30 degrees negative below Fahrenheit, then it's going to freeze up. So it's very weather dependent, but we are going to start getting into the spring here in about a month or two, and things will start melting.
This change in policy from the Army, from what it had done under President Obama's orders, is this something that's coming directly from, in effect, President Trump's executive order saying, no, you guys go ahead on this?
Well, President Trump's order his recent executive order on pipelines basically instructed federal agencies to speed up its review process here. And so certainly we can certainly infer that there was basically that the Army took away from that its need to sort of approve this. What's most interesting for me is that the environmental impact statement that the Obama administration had said it would conduct on the pipeline, that is something the Standing Rock Sioux want, the Trump administration is now saying they didn't need to do that. And legally, they don't have to do that, but it is a flip-flopping, if you will, from a regulatory body, and the Standing Rock Sioux is quite annoyed that the government, in the chairman's words, when I was speaking with him this morning, basically reversed themselves.
Talking to Ernest Scheider, energy correspondent for Reuters, about the latest key approval for the Dakota Access Pipeline. As of now, the project could go forward, pending some legal challenges. And Ernest, that point you just made about the change from a requirement for this environmental impact statement, now it's not needed. Is that something that is being looked at as a venue for a legal or an opportunity for a legal challenge?
It certainly could be an area there that they were going to pursue. The Standing Rock Sioux, their main contention is that they're not really sure what damage would come from any potential leak from the pipeline, so they need to study this. Basically, slow down is what their chairman is saying and has been saying. Take a look and basically figure out what could happen in a worst-case scenario. And he is getting some help from folks that live downstream of the Missouri River because certainly they would be impacted as well. Legally, though, it's sort of a gray area right now if it's required. The Obama administration said that it thought it would implement it and that it would be required. But the Trump administration is basically just saying, well, there's no statute here, so we're going to reverse it. There is certainly what one could say a legal case for the tribe to pursue with this and related matters. It's still unclear, though, if that will succeed. By and large, though, it's a huge blow to the tribe to have the easement issued that's going to basically take the wind out of their sails when they go before a judge.
Are there other legal grounds that they're looking at? I think you wrote about maybe sovereignty, sovereign land issues being something they might bring up in a legal challenge.
Yes, this has some merit, although it's been very risky and has not been fully tested in the courts yet. The idea that the land that the pipeline will be built on, which of course is not on the current Indian reservation, used to belong to the tribe, and in the 19th century was taken away from the tribe by the United States Congress. So the idea that this was land that was initially owned by the tribe, and thus the tribe has legal right to oppose it because it is sort of a de facto original owner, that has not fully been tested, and certainly I think it would be an issue that a lot of people beyond the Dakota Access Pipeline would like to see addressed by the United States Supreme Court or others. It would have huge ramifications beyond just North Dakota right now, because basically what you have is a tribe saying that we used to own vastly more, much more land than we have now, but that amount of land was taken away from us, so we should be able to control what goes on there. So you could imagine how that would just open up a whole, basically, can of worms as to, you know, what that would mean all across the United States.
A big part of why the Dakota Access Pipeline became such a national story has to do with the protests that have gone on there. Are you expecting to see a lot more protests now that this decision has been, in effect, reversed?
Well, what we're starting to see is protests all around the United States increasing. David Archambault, who is the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux, told me this morning in an interview that he really wants people to go to their state capitals, talk to their congressional representatives, put pressure on them about it. He really is looking at a political front now to open up in a battle against the pipeline. They have asked and are continuing to ask folks not to come to North Dakota, not to come to the Osseti Sakowan camp there near Standing Rock, because of the weather. It's quite cold there right now. Just imagine camping outside. Not a lot of people in Wisconsin camp outside, and not a lot of people in North Dakota camp outside, but these people are there, and I was there at the camp during a blizzard recently, and I can tell you it's not a fun experience. And then you combine that with the coming thaw, expected in the spring, of course, so all this snow melts. And so you've got the camp in a floodplain, and so the danger there is that floodwaters from the Missouri River could basically just pick up all this detritus that's been left behind, including tents, sleeping bags, propane tanks, and basically just carry that all downstream and create its own ecological disaster. So right now the state and tribes and federal officials are working to clean up the camp. So for all of those reasons, the tribe, the Army Corps, Governor Doug Burgum in Bismarck are asking for nobody to come back and for the camp actually to vacate.
And since this decision was handed down, what have we heard from the company behind the pipeline and other supporters?
Well, they're certainly very happy that they can move forward on this. I think it's, they spent a lot of money to basically keep things in limbo, and so they want to move forward on this. The North Dakota congressional delegation, which is comprised of two Republicans and a Democrat, all of them are sort of united in their support of the project and are happy that it can move forward now and sort of have some certainty there. Remember, North Dakota is the second largest oil-producing state in the nation, so they want to be able to get that oil to market. And because if they can't, that really affects the state's tax revenue.
We'll leave it there for now. Ernest, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Great to be with you.
We've been talking to Ernest Scheider, energy correspondent for Reuters. He joined us to talk about the U.S. Army's decision to grant the final permit needed to complete the Dakota Access Pipeline. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we talk with a Wisconsin climate scientist about the state of climate change research and what the current trends mean here in the state.
Right now, it's time to get the latest news in national politics. The hearings over the immigration ban took place last night. We'll learn what could be in store for the executive order moving forward.
Last night, Senator Elizabeth Warren was formally silenced on the Senate floor by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, leading to outrage among many Warren supporters.
Scott Wong joins us now for a look at those and other stories. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill, covering House Republicans and Speaker Paul Ryan, among other things. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, Scott, this immigration hearing happened last night. Pretty big hearings for your average federal court hearing. You don't usually see millions of people watching something like this. They're not going to make a judgment today, it sounds like. What do we know from what we saw last night, though?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think there was record viewership. I mean, the cable networks were all tuned in to this court hearing. People were following this on Twitter, on social media, streaming it live, typically for a appellate court hearing that is highly unusual. What we heard was arguments from both sides to the Ninth Circuit Court, a panel of three judges. Attorneys for the Justice Department argued that the executive order was a national security decision by the president and that the court should not be interfering with that decision by the president. That he was trying to protect the country in issuing this unilateral action. Attorneys from the other side representing the states of Washington and Minnesota are seeking to completely halt Trump's order. They argued that the original intent of the ban was to block Muslims from entering the country, essentially a religious ban which would be unconstitutional under the First Amendment. And so right now, we are not expecting a ruling today. We are expecting something to come down later this week. But all indications are, because both sides are so dug in on both sides, that this is going to somehow end up at the Supreme Court level. And as you know, the Supreme Court currently is split with, on many tough decisions, 4-4, as we only have 8 Supreme Court justices.
And as you cover Congress and what's going on in D.C., is this an issue where all eyes are on this court and this issue, or is there so much going on it's not really dominating the conversation?
I would say there's a lot going on, but this issue has dominated Capitol Hill for the past week, namely because of the way it was rolled out in such a haphazard way. The leadership offices, including Paul Ryan's office, were not fully informed that this was coming down. This would have been about a week and a half ago. It was unexpected. The key leadership offices were not looped in on the decision, and so it caught a lot of people off guard and by surprise, and that didn't sit well with a lot of Republicans. And so I think going forward, there's going to be a lot more communication between Trump's congressional liaison staff and leadership on Capitol Hill. Remember, these are people that are part of the same party, and for a major decision to be made like this without consulting with Capitol Hill is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, you cover congressional Republicans. Are feathers really ruffled here over this and some of the other issues that we've seen over the last couple of weeks, or do people chalk it up to, okay, they're new, it's early in the administration, we'll get this stuff sorted out?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both. I think Republicans certainly do on Capitol Hill do want to give Trump a little bit of time to get his administration up and running. Remember, a lot of the heads of the federal agencies and members of his cabinet have not been seated yet, including his attorney general. And so there's a little bit of a grace period or a honeymoon period, if you will. On the other hand, each of these members of Congress, they represent their states and their congressional districts, and they're getting a lot of questions and phone calls in their offices. Some are getting protests. And so they are really feeling the heat on this executive order. And, you know, they want to be able to shape it as much as possible.
You mentioned the attorney general nominee, and I want to give a listen to kind of a weird moment in the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell formally silenced Senator Elizabeth Warren over testimony about President Trump's pick for the attorney general, Jeff Sessions. Here's some of that interaction.
Mr. President.
The Majority Leader.
The Senator is impugning the motives and conduct of our colleague from Alabama, as warned by the chair. Senator Warren, quote, said Senator Sessions has used the awesome power of his office to chill the free exercise of the vote by black citizens. I call the senator to order under the provisions of Rule 19.
Mr. President.
The senator from Massachusetts.
Mr. President, I am surprised
that the words of Coretta Scott King are not suitable for debate in the United States Senate, I ask leave of the Senate to continue my remarks.
Is there objection?
Object.
I appeal the ruling.
Objection is heard. The Senator will take her seat.
Mr. President,
I appeal the ruling of the chair, and I suggest the absence of a quorum.
The clerk will call the roll.
And then there was ultimately a vote, a party line vote, agreeing that with the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. This isn't something we see every day, is it, Scott?
No, it's actually quite extraordinary. You had the United States Senate voting essentially to silence one of their own members for, as you heard Mitch McConnell say, impugning the character of one of her colleagues, Senator Jeff Sessions. This is, of course, Trump's nominee for attorney general. And, you know, what this comes down to is a much bigger fight over between the Democrats and, you know, Donald Trump and his ability to try to seat members of his cabinet. And, you know, my takeaway, this exchange has gone viral, of course, as you've played it. And it's been watched now thousands, if not millions of times on YouTube and other outlets. The optics for Republicans, of course, look bad. Here you have a male senator and leader, Mitch McConnell, trying to silence a female senator, the hero of the left, Elizabeth Warren, who had been quoting Coretta Scott King, the wife of Dr. Martin Luther King. It spawned fundraising emails, Twitter hashtags, the Congressional Black Caucus, including Wisconsin's Congresswoman Gwen Moore, marched over to the Senate floor earlier this morning to protest the treatment of Elizabeth Warren. And my takeaway is this is really thrust Elizabeth Warren back into the spotlight. My prediction is you're going to be hearing from and seeing a lot more of Elizabeth Warren as she positions herself, I think, for a potential 2020 presidential run.
Ultimately, the Attorney General nominee, Jeff Sessions, probably going to get confirmed, isn't he?
I think that's right. I think, you know, it's very hard for senators to vote against somebody that you've served side by side with, you know, in this body. Of course, what we saw the other day was, a party-line vote on the education secretary nominee, Betsy DeVos, and that was a party-line vote, and they actually had to bring in the vice president to break that tie. So in the worst-case scenario, you know, they could probably, you know, at least get 51 votes. I think a lot more Democrats are going to give Sessions the benefit of the doubt, and you may see a much bigger margin in the vote for to confirm the Attorney General.
We're talking to Scott Wong, covers the House for The Hill. He's a senior staff writer there. Scott, you've been covering issues of conflict of interest and congressional oversight over the president related to his various business interests. What is going on? What's the latest on this topic?
Well, there was an interesting meeting that happened yesterday at the White House in the Oval Office between President Trump and the oversight chairman in the House. His name is Jason Chaffetz of Utah. He's a Republican. And they discussed almost everything under the sun, from nature photography to postal reform. The one topic that they did not discuss was congressional oversight of Donald Trump and his administration. And Chaffetz, as he explained it to reporters after the meeting, he said the first thing Donald Trump said to him when he entered the Oval Office was, "We are not talking about congressional oversight in this meeting." And so that was that. The reason this meeting was significant is because Democrats have been putting extraordinary pressure on Chaffetz to conduct congressional investigations into Donald Trump with the same type of rigor that he conducted investigations into Hillary Clinton and her emails and her handling of classified documents, as well as his investigations into the Obama administration. And so right now, Chaffetz, that hasn't been his posture. His posture has been to give Donald Trump a little bit of time to get his administration up and running. But this was the first sort of one-on-one meeting between Donald Trump and the chairman that perhaps down the road could be the guy who is investigating his administration.
There have been a few stories lately, something about the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., and who runs the federal role there. The Department of Defense may be renting space in Trump Tower, I understand it. And the thing that's got a lot of attention, Nordstrom, this doesn't usually come up in presidential conversations, is apparently dialing back on the Ivanka Trump clothing line. And the president tweeted from his personal account, then retweeted from the presidential Twitter account angrily about Nordstrom's action. What do you make of all that?
I mean, again, there are so many. You just touched on a couple of the multitude of issues that are out there that Democrats have been crying foul about, saying that Donald Trump is involved in all of these conflicts of interest. In regard to the Nordstrom issue, yeah, Donald Trump tweeted today at Nordstrom saying that, you know, their treatment of Ivanka by pulling her clothing line out of their stores was terrible and unfair. Then you had Sean Spicer, the press secretary from the White House podium, saying that Nordstrom's actions were a direct attack on the president and on Ivanka's good name. And so you just have this convoluting of the, you know, White House official business with some of the family's business interests. Now, Ivanka has stepped away from her role running the Ivanka line of products, just as President Trump has stepped away from the Trump business organization. But they certainly have this bully pulpit in the presidency and specifically from the White House podium, where they are warning corporations, you know, you're either with us or against us. And it's something that not many of us have seen in our time in Washington.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill, covering House Republicans and Speaker Paul Ryan. He joined us with a look at the latest in political news from Washington, D.C.
Coming up after the news, we look into the science of climate change, what we know, how we know it, and how it might affect Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll hear live coverage of Governor Walker's budget address and then take a look at some of the big news items in his budget plan.
First, climate change continues to be a big story in state and national news. We hear about climate data taken off the state DNR website, federal cabinet nominees question on their climate change positions, and now a federal agency under fire over how it handles temperature readings from decades ago. When it comes to the basics of climate science and research, what do we know and how do we know it?
Joining us to discuss research into climate change and what trends we're seeing in Wisconsin is Dan Bimont. He's an associate professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison and co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. Dan, thanks for being here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, from a scientific perspective, let's start with the freshest information that scientists know. What do we know right now about climate change and what is going on with temperatures?
That's a good question. So right now, we're coming off of the warmest year on record. 2016 was the warmest year on record, which beat 2015 as the warmest year on record prior to that. And those 2 years are notable not only because of this long-term trend that we're seeing in warming, but also because they were large El Nino events. And so a lot of the warming that we've seen for these 2 years in particular can be attributed to these El Nino events on top of a slowly warming global climate.
But scientists take El Nino events into account as they look at these long-term trends. Is that right?
Absolutely. El Nino is a big form of natural variability in our climate system. In fact, it's the largest thing that can happen to our climate system other than just the annual cycle. And so when we look at long-term warming, we do take into account these kinds of variations.
And according to the Nelson Institute, 15 of the 16 warmest years on record have come since 2001. How far back do these temperature records go, and what is the scientific protocol and how you keep these records?
These records go back to about the 1800s, the mid-1800s for some data. But data coverage gets more and more sparse as you get really far back. And so we feel pretty comfortable with global temperature records back from, say, the mid to late 1800s. And then moving forward, prior to that, coverage just isn't good enough, and we just don't have the data for that.
And are there, as you go back decades and centuries, are there different ways to determine temperatures or how scientists did things in their procedure of recording temperature?
Yes, and this has been in the news quite a bit in the last few months with the recalculation of historical temperatures. From the NOAA,
National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
That's right. From the National Climatic Data Center, which I believe has a new acronym to it now. I have trouble keeping up with all the changing alphabet soup here. But so the way that we've measured temperatures has evolved with technology. And so prior to World War II, most temperature records were most temperatures over in the ocean. Were measured actually by a bucket method. So you grab a bucket of water, you bring it up, and you take the temperature of the bucket of water. The problem is that as you're bringing that bucket up to the ship, a little bit of evaporation occurs, which cools the water. And so earlier records would correct for that prior to World War II. And one of the big findings in the recent recalculation was that that still makes a big difference. There's still a lot of ships that are taking temperature records from buckets, which is fine. It's just that we need to correct for it in the actual global temperature records.
It seems like it would be a minuscule amount.
It's on the order of a tenth of a degree. So that's,
but that matters.
That matters a lot, right? Uh-huh. Because that's a decade worth of warming or so. So it's that's a big number. When you're talking on these global trends, it's a slow warming trend. But when you average over the whole globe, it's a big deal.
And we're hearing reports of a massive and rapidly growing crack in an Antarctic ice shelf and an iceberg the size of Delaware. What can you tell us about this and climate change?
Yeah, that's an area I'm not tremendously familiar with. However, I mean, we're seeing just some amazing changes in the Arctic and Antarctic this year. Sea ice. There's a big difference between sea ice and sea ice. Sea ice has reached record minimum extents. And what's strange is that that's occurring at a time of year that usually there's a lot of recovery of sea ice. So it's not just the end of the summer season in the Northern Hemisphere, for example. Temperatures in the Arctic have been just astronomically warm. And that's a current research issue that we're, as a climate science community, trying to identify what are the causes of that and what are the potential implications of that warming in the Arctic region. So we're seeing some amazing things this year that we need some answers and theory for.
We're talking with Dan Vimont. He's a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, the director of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research, and co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. And so sea level rise as well here, occurring at twice the global average and at the highest rate along the Atlantic coast. Can you unpack this for us? What does this mean in our real life here?
Sea levels is far more interesting than it may seem. So one of the my apologies to anyone who actually studies sea level out there. It seems very interesting to me, at least. Sea level rise can occur for two main reasons. One is if there is a loss of land ice, a melting of ice on land that would then run off into the ocean. And the other reason that sea level will be rising is just as water warms, it expands, and therefore you end up with higher sea levels. And what's interesting is that the spatial distribution of sea level rise is not uniform. If you just dump a bunch more water into the ocean, or if you warm the ocean uniformly, the change in sea level is not uniform, and that's due to the way that these large ice sheets affect our gravitational field. And so you end up with changes that can be very different and regionally dependent. That has there are huge implications for this on the East Coast. I think I heard recently that if the sanitation or the sewer system in D.C. were to get flooded, which it gets close occasionally, if it were to flood out, then D.C. would be without sanitary sewer for 3 months. Mm. And the implications of something like that are enormous. And the writing is on the wall that in the next century, we should see anywhere between 1 foot and 4 feet of sea level rise. So this is going to be a major issue.
And skeptics of climate change, they often cite natural variations in the Earth's climate as a reason for the rising temperature and atmospheric conditions that we're seeing. Based on your modeling, is it possible to explain climate change without the effect of humans?
Not on the timescale that we've seen. And that's what the big difference is here. We certainly take climate variations into effect. That's actually my major area of research. I got into climate change after that. But if we run models with the observed change in human-induced greenhouse gases and without human-induced greenhouse gases, then we cannot reproduce the warming that we've observed unless we include the anthropogenic, so human-caused greenhouse gas changes that we've observed in the last, say, 100 years or so.
But still, there is such this heated debate that it's not happening.
Well, that debate isn't really happening in scientific circles.
Okay.
And that's a key distinction I like to make here. There's two issues related to climate change. One, the science of climate change. And then the other, what do we do about it? The former is a scientific process. It's a bunch of scientists discussing and so forth. It's thermometers, right? It's hard to argue with a thermometer. The other is a political process. What do we do about it? How do we reduce the amount of climate change? How much should we plan on reducing climate change? How much should we plan on adapting? Those two questions are both necessary because we're beyond the point where we're going to stop climate change or even stopping at a dangerous level is going to require a lot of work. And so we need to be prepared for an adaptation as well.
We're talking with Dan Bimont, the co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, about the current state of climate science and what climate change means for life in Wisconsin.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about climate change science and research? Do you think climate change is a serious problem and that people are making it worse? Or do you still have doubts about the role humans are playing in the environment? What kind of policies do you want to see at the federal or state levels when it comes to the climate? And what do you want to know about how it might affect us here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the current state of climate science, what we know, how we know it, and its impact on life here in Wisconsin. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Are you curious about how climate scientists come up with their information and predictions? Is climate change something you think about? Do you live in an area or work in an industry that has been affected by climate change? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dan Bimont stays with us. He's a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison and co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts.
And Dan, getting back to our conversation here, focusing a moment on Wisconsin, how have changes in Wisconsin's climate and the environment here compared to the rest of the country and perhaps around the world?
Changes here in Wisconsin have been pretty comparable to the rest of the country and the rest of the world. Globally, the climate has warmed by about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 115, 20 years, whatever. Since about 1950, we've observed about the same here in Wisconsin. That warming has been more pronounced in wintertime than summertime, which is an interesting question in itself. And it's also consistent with our projections forward, which is based on independent information. The projections forward on climate change suggest that winter will warm more than summer, that nighttime low temperatures will warm more than daytime high temperatures. And so those kinds of changes that we've observed are very consistent with what you might expect due to anthropogenic climate change.
What does that mean for Wisconsin lakes? What does that mean for, just how we go about our lives season to season and do what we do here in Wisconsin?
That is a really complicated question, it turns out, because all of us are so diverse. We have so many different interests. And so, you know, a few things that this means is that, for example, warm temperatures are not good for trout. And so trout habitat is likely to decrease considerably. In the DNR, the Driftless area, people are working on looking at where trout refugia may be. We will see shifts in forest composition. One species is paper birch. We might see a loss of paper birch in northern Wisconsin. Lake temperatures could be warming, and there's some interesting effects that occur based on the size of the lake, that small lakes tend to be a little more sheltered from some mixing processes. And so it may depend on the size of the lake. Increased heat waves, which are the biggest cause of mortality from natural disasters in Wisconsin. More people have died from heat waves in Wisconsin than every other natural disaster combined, which surprised me. I didn't realize that. But heat waves are expected to triple in frequency and increase in intensity as well. So there's a whole variety depending on what we are. Depending on your interests, right? What you care about.
Let's take a call now. Harry from Madison. Hi, Harry.
Good afternoon. I don't know if Dan has gotten to this or not. I had a climate science course last semester, so I know enough to be dangerous. But I really welcome his comments on the oceans. According to the course material that came from NASA, the oceans serve as carbon sinks. And as that carbon has built up over eons, they reach a capacity level. And, of course, as the water warms, the amount of carbon it can retain also declines. So I think that's an unmentioned story, generally speaking. And this feeds into the second part of my question about the Arctic Ocean ice. There's a lot of talk about how far the ice goes, the extent of the ice, but there seems to be very little commentary about the volume, the thickness of the ice, which has been declining for decades. So that if you were to take that square mile area and then consider the thickness of the ice, the diminishment of the ice is even more dramatic than most people realize.
Wow, great, great question there, Harry. Thanks. the first part of that, you're absolutely correct. As the oceans warm, they become less able to absorb carbon from the atmosphere. Currently, about half of what we put into the atmosphere gets absorbed by either the ocean or land. How the ocean takes that up is actually a really interesting process. That's affected by the temperature of the ocean. And it's also affected by, to a certain extent, the acidity of the ocean, which increases with more carbon dioxide that gets absorbed, more carbon that gets absorbed. I don't think we're at a point yet where the ocean is going to stop taking up carbon, but it's currently taking about a quarter of what we put in, but that will diminish in the future, most likely.
All right. Well, thank you, Harry, for your insights. Matt from Madison. Hi, Matt.
Hi. How's it going?
Great. What would you like to add?
I was curious how farming, and in particular cow farming, and I guess the food industry in general, has an impact on climate change and what we could or do about it and why maybe that's not happening.
Wow. The last part of that is the really tricky one, why that's not happening. Farming does can have an impact on climate change in either way. I think sequestering carbon down into the soil and regrowth of vegetation can actually remove carbon from the atmosphere. But at the same time, nitrous oxides are important greenhouse gases, and those can be byproducts of fertilization and so forth. Also methane in terms of animal farming. So it does have an effect. What we can do about it, I think there's a lot of research going on both at the University of Wisconsin here and around the country looking at how to sequester some of those gases and how to potentially even use in the case of methane. There's a great example of that in the Driftless area with capturing methane and then using it for community, energy source.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Matt. Let's go to Chuck in Lilly. Hi, Chuck.
Yeah, hi. My question is what's been the consideration of human-created heat from the millions of automobiles we run? Every machine we operate generates heat. My house is bleeding heat into the environment as well as every other dwelling in the world. What's been considered the impact of that on the rising temperatures?
Good question. There's two ways to answer that. One is the direct effect of that energy. And when you burn, say, a ton of coal or something, you emit carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but you also produce a lot of energy. And it turns out that once you put that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that carbon dioxide sticks around for 50 or 100 years, it has thousands of times the warming potential of the actual burning of the coal itself, which surprised me when I first calculated that. It was it's the effect of the carbon as a greenhouse gas is far more intense than the actual warming that you get from burning the coal. But the second part of that is that as we've changed our environment, as we've built more urban environments and so forth, we create what's called an urban heat island effect, where urban areas with more concrete and so forth stay warmer and warm up more during the day. And that can exacerbate some of the effects of climate change. And there's some good research going on here at University of Wisconsin looking at the effect of urban heat island effects.
Well, thank you, Chuck, for your call. Margaret now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Margaret.
Hi there. I'm very interested in the aspect of farming, and the question a while ago as to why it's not happening is very pertinent to me. I'm a follower of Joel Salatin, who is a mob grazer, and he believes that we can sink the carbon into the ground if more people farmed his way, which is cover cropping. And he believes, too, that we can decrease the carbon in the atmosphere to pre-industrial levels if we were to cover the ground, which, of course, isn't done in the United States with all these row cropping and monocropping.
So the research I've seen on cover cropping and also no-till has a huge effect on soil quality and so forth. The one thing that I do want to caution on, though, is that there is no one solution for this, and that can help. It absolutely helps. And I want to applaud you for those kind of practices, because all of us working together, doing whatever we can, is what's going to help. And any individual action is probably not going to be enough. And that's kind of a frightening state of affairs, but it's also an important one for all of us to keep in mind. So thanks for doing what you're doing.
And any final thoughts here as we wrap up very quickly? What can Wisconsinites do to fight climate change in our own lives every day?
I think we need to be aware of it and cognizant of it. It's, you know, and oftentimes sometimes I feel like climate change sounds doom and gloom, and I keep reminding people, you know, especially in my classes, you will fall in love. You will be amazed by places in this world. You will do great things in your lives. It's just we're going to do that within a warming climate. So be aware.
Dan, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks a lot.
That was Dan Vimond, Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison and the co-chair of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is Central Time.